I'm going to talk about what it means to be a bodhisattva in this modern world, in this contemporary time of ours. And I'll say something about what a bodhisattva is. So a bodhisattva is someone who attains or aspires to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And in a way, we could say we're all bodhisattvas in training. We're all treading the path in order to benefit beings and be of service in the world, service of love, service of wisdom. And so we don't practice for our own liberation individually, and you could even argue that's not even possible. How could it be an individual endeavor? But because we are wanting all beings to be free. So it's an intensely altruistic imperative. So if you put it in more contemporary language, unless everyone is free, no one is free. And this is the spirit of the second phase, the great second phase of Buddhism, called the Mahayana, which translates as the Great Way. So what do bodhisattvas do? Well, bodhisattvas respond. They respond to the cries of the world, and they do it in all sorts of ways. So sometimes it's about taking care of other beings. So that might be carers or youth workers or health workers or social workers or people who look after natural places. So it's that taking care aspect. Or it might be about creating positive alternatives, a vision for a different way of living. So that might include a community garden or a family centre or an arts centre, or teaching people poetry. You know, it's kind of those things we do to vision a better life, a better world. And sometimes it's about trying to prevent harm. So that might include all of the work that activists and campaigners might do in different ways. So this talk's theme has two launch pads. One is that we're now moving into the area of perfect livelihood. So we're on the next part of the Eightfold Path. And also, I just want to acknowledge that June is Buddhist Action Month, and I'm going to say what that is and how we celebrate that and mark that. And they both fit together very well. And I think as I go on, you'll see how they fit together. So perfect livelihood then, from Sangharakshita's 1968 talk on perfect livelihood, he makes the point that up until now, up until all the stages of the Noble Eightfold Path we've looked at so far, we've been looking initially at perfect vision, and then the first three steps of the transformation phase of the path. So there's transforming our emotions to give us impetus or momentum to realize the vision, to manifest the vision. And then we're transforming our actions and our speech in alignment with perfect vision. So perfect livelihood. Well, Buddhism includes the creation of an ideal society as well as, you could say, the ideal individual. We are all parts of society, and it's very difficult to change ourselves while society remains unchanged. So there's that mutual relationship. We're in an environment. And I really like the metaphor that Sangharakshita offers in this talk on perfect livelihood. He says, it's all very well to talk about the lotus blooming in the midst of the mire, but it's very difficult to be a lotus when the mire is particularly nasty and all pervasive. So using that metaphor of sort of growing up out of the mud into the you know, the beautiful lotus growing up above the mud and the pool. But if the pool is actually toxic, it's extremely difficult for that poor little bud to kind of make its way up and actually kind of reach its potential. So then he goes on a little bit further down. He says, perfect livelihood connotes our economic lives. So it has that sense of how you earn your living, but it also stands for political and social engagement with life. So, woo, now there's this word political, which is very interesting. And you might be surprised to hear Buddhism can indeed should be political and apply to politics. After all, the combination of religion and politics has not gone well in human history. It's not been a good combination in many cases. But when I say politics, I mean politics in its kind of most fundamental sense, in a way, its most basic sense, which is it's to do with the governing of people, groups of people. That's all politics really means. If you look it up in a dictionary, that's the meaning. So it might be a town, might be a nation, it might be another grouping of people of a different size, but that's what it means. And the Buddha did actually get involved in politics on that level. So he gave quite a lot of advice to kings. So in the Buddha's day, the king was the kind of governing ruler and the political leaders of the society. So I wonder what he might say to political leaders today. You know, if taking that as a model, he would be engaging with politicians now. So I think there is something in what people fret about when it comes to Buddhism and politics, and I think it's more to do with that word partisan politics. And I looked up the definition of partisan. I thought I knew what it meant, but I wanted to just look it up. And in the Merriam-Webster dictionary, it's defined as feeling, showing, or deriving from strong and sometimes blind adherence to a particular party, faction, cause, or person. So strong and sometimes blind adherence to a particular party, faction, cause, or person. And the Collins dictionary says someone whose partisan strongly supports a particular person or cause, often without thinking carefully about the matter. So there's this sense of it not being considered and coupled with a strength of feeling. So you might say that the person holding a partisan position is unwilling to consider another point of view because they're so sort of embattled and almost dogmatic about their own position. So I've just finished, I really enjoyed this book. I just finished reading Barack Obama's autobiography, Promised Land. And, you know, his qualities shine out of that book, really. I'm a big fan of Obama. And I was thinking I would find it really hard to consider the idea that a policy that came out of the Trump administration would be better for society than a policy that might come out of the Obama administration. You know, I would struggle with that possibility that might be true. Which wouldn't be, it's not like to acknowledge that possibility, wouldn't be to say that I think Trump is a more admirable person than Obama, but you know, that might be true. It might be true. There's some policy somewhere that actually did a lot of good. And maybe one of Obama's wasn't so good. I really struggle to even grant that. And if I did grudgingly acknowledge it, I also know it might be difficult to say that to some of my friends. So I might not say it at all. But, you know, so in a way, I'm sort of acknowledging my own, a certain sort of partisan attitude of my own is that I'm so sort of doggedly anti-Trump and pro-Obama that I would struggle to give Trump any credit at all. So when I listen, I notice that when I listen to a news story, I can sometimes hear a voice which says quite quietly inside my head, what side am I supposed to be on here? Does anyone else get that? Mm-hmm. Well, especially a new news item breaking. What side? What's my side? What side, with someone with my loyalties, which side would I sympathize with? I'm kind of listening for buzzwords, the words I'm attracted to, some I'm not, some words I feel criticized by and critical of. and those I align with, and it can happen quite quickly. And I also notice how much I'm rushing to take a position, almost like there's a kind of urgency, like I'm disorientated unless I know what side I'm on and what I think about it. So, yeah, so there's a way we can hold on to values and support a side most of the time, maybe, but maybe we can also be willing to question our loyalty at least sometimes and to stay open to the evidence without making it fit our preferences. And that is really hard to do. And maybe we can stay conscious of our pull to take a side. And I don't mean sit on the fence either, because sometimes it's really important to decide where you stand. So we practice ethics in the context of the societies we live in. And as well as advising kings on the best way to govern, the Buddha also commented on social structures. And a very quoted, much quoted example of his engagement with social issues of his time was his rejection of the caste system, the most widespread. So this was the most widespread inequity that existed in his society at the time, and which, as you probably know, still has an impact on people's lives today. So a few weeks ago, Subhuti, one of the more senior order members in Triratna, he gave a talk at the London Buddhist Centre on Buddha Day, and he called it the Buddha's Social Revolution. And I'm just going to quote a bit of this talk because I did find it a fascinating talk. The Buddha, at the same time as directly rejecting the social hierarchy, and then he sort of says in parentheses, and we can take it that although he was talking about caste, he meant everyone, race, gender, whatever. He rejected all hierarchy. And bluntly, flatly, vigorously, and actively. But he did that because he saw that it stands in the way of true human solidarity. It stands in the way of what human beings can really be for each other. It stands in the way of maitri or metta. Maitri is the Sanskrit word, metta is the Pali word. The Buddha, in refuting the caste system and therefore all social hierarchy, he is asserting maitri. So the Buddha didn't just comment on the evils of social hierarchy, although he repeatedly did throughout the Pali Canon. In one case of we know of, he actually set up a kind of affirmative action system, which is to say an approach of equity rather than equality. What I mean by that is that equality is about giving everybody the same thing, whereas equity is about noticing the existence of imbalance and giving what's needed to level out the situation. So to put it another way, you take account of the disadvantage and then you balance things out. So you'll see what I mean from the story. And it's the story of Upali the Baba. So at the time, society was based on strata to do with birth, which has continued down through the millennia. So called the caste system, it's about a person's role in society being defined by inheritance or the family that you're born into. So if your ancestors are merchants, then you become a merchant. If your ancestors are servants or street sweepers, then you become a servant or a street sweeper. And your place in society is very rigidly maintained on that level. And if you're on the lowest levels, you're seen to be impure and sort of potentially polluting the people on the higher levels. So the Buddha's spiritual community rejected all of that. He did have a system of who paid respects to whom. So things like who ate first, who bowed to whom. It was fairly light, but it was based on seniority largely, and which was that was about how when you were ordained. So a more junior monk would bow to a more senior one. A junior nun would eat after a more senior one, and so on. And so it got away from the whole status to do with caste. And the story goes that there was a period when the Buddha wanted to ordain several people. And most of them were princes. In fact, they were all princes, apart from one who was a barber. And in the society at the time, the barber would have been quite low caste because he was dealing with sort of human human waste, I suppose, in a way. So the Buddha made the decision to ordain the barber first. Just let you think about that, why that might have been. He ordained the barber first as a deliberate tactic. And he specifically said that the reason was that the princes who were ordained second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, etc., would need to pay their respects to the barber. So this might be the first recorded example of affirmative action. He was deliberately trying to reset the situation to kind of even out this pre-existing level of social status, which would have existed between the princes and the barber. So this area I'm describing is called engaged Buddhism, which I wanted to just wave a few books. The kind of scriptural source of how to be an engaged Buddhist, you could say it comes in the Bodhicaryavatara, which is a very beloved text, very ancient text. That's a book on how to be a bodhisattva. And we've studied it, we've done retreats on it, we do mitra study on it. It's called A Guide to the Buddhist Path to Awakening by Shantideva. And then we have a number of writers in Triratna who are very strong on this topic. One of them is Akupa, who's done talks in the Sangha before, a friend of mine. And he wrote a book called Saving the Earth, which is a lovely little book on how to apply Buddhism to environmental activism in particular, environmental action. And then there are many books outside our movement as well. This is quite a well-known, it's an oldie but goodie, this one, The Engaged Spiritual Life by Donald Rothberg. And you can find these in the library. I just pulled these out of the library just now. So that's where to look for more on this. But I wanted to say a little bit about what I think the challenges are for being a bodhisattva, what they may face. It is a challenging practice. It's quite an advanced practice in many ways. And I thought of four ways in which people can get waylaid when they get involved in these more society level practices. So I'm speaking here from an experience of working in, well, I was going to say secular groups, but actually I think some of this, what I'm going to say actually applies to kind of groups of Buddhists working together on these issues as well, to do with racism, poverty, inequality, climate change, and so on. But if your bodhisattva activity is takes a different form, you may be able to find parallels. So what I'm talking about more is those kind of groupings of people active in these different spheres. And my list roughly corresponds to the five hindrances which we find in meditation. So some of you that know those will spot those as we go through. I've combined, there's four, and there's five hindrances, and I've got four topics. So actually two of them combine. The first, I'll explain that first. So the first one is some sort of combination of restlessness, anxiety, and doubt. It's a little sort of little mix there. So over the years, I've noticed that there's a lot of wasted time and energy worrying about what the best thing is to do and how. I've witnessed people under my, well, I've not only witnessed people, I've done it myself. I've done it myself to myself. These questions that just kind of torment, you know, am I doing the right thing? Is this the right way? Should I be doing more? Should I be doing something else? Should I be doing it differently? And this is made worse by the fact that there is always someone ready to be critical and telling you that doing how you're doing what you're doing is useless or counterproductive or worse. And so my suggestion is that you find ways to decide on what your approach is carefully in light of the precepts. Does it come from love? That's the fundamental precept question, really. And then when you've done that, try not to get waylaid by doubt, which will try to divert you. So, it's a sort of, it's a kind of trusting in your own process to arrive at where you've got, which is not to say that you can't change course, but it's very, very undermining to have that kind of constant niggling. So my second point comes under the heading of ill will. So, of course, in trying to do this work, there will be mistakes, and nobody could do anything operating in such a complex environment and not make them. And then when we're working with other people, of course, conflicts come up and niggles and disputes and disagreements and so on, falling out. And I think we really need to pay attention to how we deal with that creatively. How can we be ready to take care of the process of forgiving ourselves and each other? And I can honestly say, I think this is the biggest way in which I think resources are squandered in these movements, is by the battles that go on within them. And so there has to be a culture of sorting that out well as well. And then there's the whole thing about the relationship with those who oppose you and who those people you oppose. There are many references to the work of a bodhisattva being to protect beings. And therefore, the people doing the harm, you're trying to kind of step between the people doing the harm and the people being harmed. And they're not going to like it, those people who are doing the harm. And so there's that, that to deal with. How can you come from love and not anger and vengefulness? And I want to describe a practice I learned from the activist and Buddhist teacher, Joanna Macy. Again, very, very interesting person to look up on this. I trained with her about 15 years ago, and she's got a lot of very beautiful practices, and one of them is called bowing to your adversaries. And the purpose of this ritual is to overcome ill will in relation to your adversaries, people you oppose. So this is the exercise. Everyone stands with enough room in front of them to kneel and touch the ground with their hands and their forehead. Or, if they prefer, people can simply bow from the waist. And the guide reads the text aloud, pausing after each paragraph, at which point everyone, the guide included, bows and touches the ground. And each bow is marked by a bell or a gong. So imagine it, you've got a room, imagine a room full of people with everyone facing the shrine. And the guide is reading out these sentences. And the sentences go a bit like this. This is speaking to the adversary, you who destroy the natural world for profit, you show me how much I respect and honor our planet home and fellow beings. So I bow to you in gratitude and touch the earth. Here's another one. You bring forth in me the love I feel for this life-bearing land, its soil, air, and waters, and for the community that rises in its defense. Because of the strength with which I resist your actions, I learn how strong my love really is. I bow to you in gratitude and touch the earth. Because your actions challenge me to see the limits to my own understanding, they free me from holding my view as the only correct one. I bow to you and in gratitude and touch the earth. And so can you imagine, after each phrase, people get down and bow, get up, and then they listen for the next phrase. It's a really, really strong practice. And I did this practice once with someone who'd been involved in a protest which turned out to be extremely dangerous. And And what he'd done was that he'd blocked a bridge as part of a protest at the G8 summit in Switzerland. And it was a globalization. Do you remember around that time there were lots of big globalization protests? And he was blocking the road to prevent the leaders, the G8 leaders, from arriving at the venue. And so it was a non-violent protest. But what they'd done is that he was a climber and his partner was a climber, and they'd abseiled over a bridge, counterbalancing each other's weights. So now they were like dangling off the side of the bridge with the rope holding them both. And there were people around the rope protecting the rope. Anyway, whether it was out of misunderstanding or deliberateness, the Swiss police, someone from the Swiss police came along and sliced the rope. And the protesters rushed to catch Martin's partner, who they caught and managed to hold her weight. But Martin dropped 20 metres. Fortunately, he fell in water, otherwise he would have been killed. But he did, he was really damaged, and he broke his back and his ankle and his foot. And I watched him do this practice, this bowing practice, 2 years after this. And I wondered, as I watched him do it, whether he had in mind the person who cut the rope. And I saw him struggling with this practice, but he did it. I could see him kind of like, he wasn't expecting it to be, you know, to happen. He's like, whoa. But he did the practice, and it was something, really something to be with him. I was standing right behind him. So, yeah. So then there are people who aren't exactly your adversaries in that sense, but they don't agree with you. And there can be such a lot of ill will and tied up in that dynamic. And I really recognize that in myself. So I make a practice to try and pay attention to opposing arguments with as much non-judgmental energy as I can. So I really try to pay attention. What comes up when I deliberately listen to an argument that contradicts my own? What comes up in me? What does my body do when I listen to a YouTube video of someone who says the completely opposite thing I believe on, say, anti-racism or something like that? What am I trying to defend? What is my identification with my own side? And why is it so strong? So it's not to say that it's changing my mind, but I'm just trying to notice my own againstness, because againstness is not the path of love and wisdom. It's not to say, you know, as I think I hope I've explained already, protest can be love. Protecting people from harm can be love. But what I'm talking about here is ill will and againstness and sort of righteous indignation. So then there's craving, which I'll touch on briefly. For me in this area, it's all around achievement, especially when it's connected to something you feel really deeply about. There's always more to do. And this can turn into a sort of workaholism. I remember an environmental campaigning friend who worked so unceasingly that there was a story that we often told, which was that when she went to the cinema, while the trailers were going on before the main film, she would sit in the corridor outside with a computer writing emails just to get the last little bit of work done before she actually went into the movie. And so we need to actively cultivate an attitude that we're not alone, and that the results are not the measure of our own worth. And we're not in control of how the outcome lands either. You know, we're contributing what we can, but we need to take account of metta for ourselves. And then finally, there's sloth and torpor. You know, in meditation, that's the kind of, you know, nodding off and feeling vague and kind of dull. And the same in this area too. You know, it's easy to go numb. I can do that very easily. There's so many things that need to be tackled. It's so overwhelming. And maybe we can rationalize it a bit by thinking that Buddhism teaches that you don't get involved, you don't take sides, you stick to a moderate position, with feeling so tepid that nothing could ever happen as a result of it. On the one hand, on the other hand, sitting on the fence, that really isn't the Bodhisattva spirit. And so my invitation to you, if you're in this position, or when you're in this position, is to find your passion, cultivate it, or find someone who is passionate and encourage them and be inspired by them. Take an interest in what they do. So Buddhist Action Month tries to keep this particular approach to Buddhism, engage Buddhism alive. In the month of June, every year, I think probably for the last 10 years or so, maybe longer, 12 years, Triratna and other Buddhist groups in the UK and beyond have dedicated June as a month to highlighting this social, ecological, societal, the societal level of practice, to emphasize that that is also an important aspect of Buddhist practice.